So today we're going to be talking about selling blogging services to travel companies and tourism boards. And I know that sometimes I chide you guys about falling down the research rabbit hole with articles that you're working on, and I have to confess that I have definitely been in a research rabbit hole about this because I am currently up at our retreat house and we're doing a weekend retreat on travel content marketing this weekend. So let's launch in for today. So in particular, I want to start by sharing with you some of these statistics that I've been digging up both online and at some trade shows that I've been going to that are focused specifically on content marketing for tourism boards. So I'm going to begin by talking about why blogging now. And some of that has to do with things that are already happening that you may or may not have heard of. A lot of tourism boards right now are launching their own blogs that are explicitly blogs in terms of they're a somewhat separate entity from the main tourism board website. They have sort of a theme and a content mission, and they're being updated regularly, as opposed to some things that you may already be seeing on tourism boards, which aren't blogs, which are itineraries and other different pieces of content. But the thing is that both of those types of content we're going to look at today as blogging, and I'm going to talk to you about why you should be selling blogging services to tourism boards, because it's a really great time for them, as well as for travel companies, but it's a really great time for them to be jumping on the wave of this type of service and content marketing for themselves. And then we're going to talk about, because this is super important to understand, where the money to cover your expenses as the person doing the blog writing, doing the content marketing, comes from. Because if you don't have a really good handle on that, it's very difficult to discuss, whether it's a tourism board or a travel company, why your fee should be what it is. If you don't have a sense of the approximate amount of money that most companies are spending on this, what the return on investment is, and why they should be spending it, it's very difficult to have those conversations. So we're going to look at the other things battling for tourism boards' attention and how they make these decisions. And then we're going to talk about how to put together the context of your proposal, really. What types of things are you proposing? What are tourism boards talking about right now? What are tourism boards doing with their blogs? Why are travel companies adding blogs to their website? So as we said in the description of today's webinar, this is really about getting you guys on the same page in terms of lingo, nomenclature, but also, like I said, funding and trends with where these travel companies and tourism boards are coming from. So I didn't put them all in the slides, and I might pop over and show you a couple as well. But I've been pouring through the annual reports of a lot of tourism boards. Do you guys know that you can just go online, and even for like a tiny, tiny city like Ontario, California, find its exact budget in terms of tourism spending as well as what its goals are for the year ahead? Do you guys know that you can just find that stuff online? Just go ahead and pop in the chat box if you do or not. The thing is, I have been spending a ton of time poring over these, pulling out trends and what different companies are doing. And the thing is that it's been really amazing to see that not only are a lot of tourism boards investing in the concept of blogging right now, but they're investing hugely. They're investing in setting up entirely new sites. And what's really great about the fact that they're already doing those investments is that now they have the money available to spend on it. So how many of you guys were with us last week when we had Dan Gibson from Visit Tucson with us? Just drop a yes in the chat box if you were there. If you weren't there, then you may have heard that Dan said that they spent a lot of money last year on setting up a brand new website, and that means that this year he now has more money available to pay to commission pieces. And when they first started that new site, he did a lot of the writing himself just because his budget was tapped out. But now that the site is up and running and they don't have to pay for developers and designers and all of that, they have a lot more money to pay for writers. And one thing that I want to highlight, and I put this in the newsletter today as well, is that one of the things about this webinar right now is that I'm really, like I said, turning you on to the trends and the nomenclature and the way that travel companies and tourism boards talk about this. And so while we're definitely looking at selling these services to these entities, I'm not going to break down the very specifics of how to put together a proposal, how to have that first phone call. But we do have those available from our January month of series of webinars on travel content marketing in our webinar library. So that's another resource that we have available that I recommend you check out. And in terms of my experience with this particular topic, as I just mentioned, I've been kind of far, far down the rabbit hole for the last couple of months in learning about this, both for our retreat and the program that I mentioned, and also a new book that I'm working on. But I've also worked on these type of travel content marketing campaigns, both with tourism boards, with companies, you know, also on an individual basis, as well as larger campaigns that go through third parties, such as with Hertz and MasterCard. And for a while, I was actually earning pretty much my whole very healthy travel rating income from this type of work. So if you have more questions on, you know, the nitty-gritty aspects of it, I definitely recommend, like I said, checking out the webinars. So let's dive right in. So, like I said, one of the first things that I really want to talk about is why now? Why is this really the time for you to forget about, for the moment, whether it's email newsletters or social media or anything else, and focus on selling blogging to travel companies and tourism boards? And I keep saying travel companies and tourism boards, and I'll talk about tourism boards for a little bit, and I talk about travel companies for a little bit. And the thing is that for us as writers, the writing of it is quite similar for both of these entities. But the way that we need to approach them is different for each of these two categories. So this is something that I just pulled from some searching that I had been doing recently. This is from Travel Oregon. So this is the state tourism board for the state of Oregon. And they have recently launched a collection that they put out quarterly called Seasonal Features that they're commissioning freelance writers for. Now, one thing you'll notice on here is that they don't have a rate. And I've cut out the rest of this page, which was quite long, but they have different things that they commission essentially from unpublished writers. So this freelance section here is something that's paid for, but what I really want to point out is that they aren't necessarily going out and putting out calls for writers for this. They don't have, you know, like a job ad up saying Travel Oregon is paying $175 per feature for writers for this thing. You need to find it and you need to pitch them. And this is one of the kind of things that I've been seeing in a lot of the searches that I've been doing recently, is that there's more of these opportunities that are sort of in plain sight. But the thing is that, like I mentioned, a lot of tourism boards are developing these, and their annual report on that isn't going to come out until the end of this year. Well, really, you know, like next spring. So how do you know about those? How do you know about those opportunities that exist but aren't out there in writing, whether it's on their website or otherwise? As I mentioned, another place that you can look is in the annual reports. So I'm going to open another one just to show you for a second, because I want you to see what these annual reports look like. So here's one. We're going to look at the one for the, I mentioned earlier, greater, like even tiny, tiny places have these, like the Greater Ontario California Convention and Visitors Bureau. So this I got from their website. They're typically in PDF, but they also have some that are very interesting graphic layouts online, but you can typically always find a PDF to go through. So as we skim through here, you'll see there's a lot of president CEO messages, a lot of photos of people, but then they start to, like I said, break out their strategic plan. And this one is really lovely, and part of why I wanted to share it is that so that you can see how much information is in here. They talk about their values. This is great if you're pitching a tourism board to know what is important to them from a value standpoint, from a strategic standpoint, and from an overall vision. And so they talk about what are their strategic anchors, what are their five-year initiatives, and then they talk about what they've done before. And one of the things that I really want to highlight here, and you'll see this with tourism boards when you go through these annual reports, is that room nights, bookings are one of the biggest factors by which they measure their success. So when we talk about travel companies, especially if it's tour companies, the ROI being return on investment calculation, is usually very closely related to bookings. With tourism boards, it is as well, but in a slightly sideways way, because people are typically booking in the hotels in the tourism board's jurisdiction rather than directly with the tourism board, so to say. But still, bookings or actual money spent are important. So anytime you're thinking about pitching a tourism board, it's really important to remember that that's their bottom line. Their bottom line is hotel bookings. Now, why is this something that might be contrary to what a lot of us think about? Is that especially if you're looking at your area or things near you, you might automatically gravitate towards talking about day activities or day trips nearby, but it's really important to remember that room nights or overnights are very important to tourism boards, and that's one of the things that they really want to push. Because you might not realize this, but tourism boards are typically funded by all those extra taxes that you hate when you go to a hotel. Like, it says that the hotel room costs $122, but then there's a 17% this tax and a 5% this tax and sales tax, and then it ends up being like $183, and you don't really know how that happened. A lot of those taxes go towards paying for the tourism boards. Now, that's not to say that they promote hotels explicitly because that's what pays for them, but that's an important indicator for tourism boards. And so when you're looking through a lot of these annual reports, that's a major factor that you're going to see, is how their room night bookings have grown. And so you'll see on here, they say total ROI achieved 29-1. So when they talk about ROI in the context of a travel, in the context of a CVB, a Convention and Visitors Bureau, or a DMO, we're going to talk a little bit more about definitions, but in the context of a tourism board, when they talk about ROI, or return on investment, they mean the amount of money that they spent versus the total economic impact. So I'm not going to give you a whole economics lesson here. Honestly, I don't know, slash I think a lot of people can't tell you exactly how the total economic impact is calculated, but total economic impact is one of the other main things that tourism boards are looking at. So this is the money spent in their destination related to tourism. So this takes into account things like day trippers and restaurant bookings and tours and all those other things besides hotels that visitors are spending money on. So one of the important things to look at here is that tourism boards are thinking about their return on investment in terms of how much money they spend proportionally to the economic impact, okay? And this 29-1, I wanted to show you because this is a pretty common number that I've seen. 29, 30, 33, these are the numbers that tourism boards are looking at. So when we talk about return on investment with tourism boards, it needs to be quite high in terms of the proportion between money spent and income. However, when we talk about travel companies, especially small travel companies, which are the ones that I recommend that you target, the relationship between what they are spending versus what they expect to get back doesn't need to be as high as a margin as it does with the travel, with the tourism boards. Okay, so for travel companies, like a 10% return on investment sounds very, very nice. More than that is great. But with tourism boards, you want to look at this 30%. But again, it's not necessarily direct bookings. It's this kind of obtuse number that includes restaurants, hotels, tours, all sorts of different impact numbers, shopping, things like that. Okay, so this, I wanted to, again, use this particular annual report as an example because they do go into a lot of detail on a lot of things, and the economic impact is also one of them. So this is one that I recommend you download if you want to sort of start to figure out how to use these to your advantage. And again, this is the Greater Ontario Convention and Visitors Bureau. So another reason I wanted to show you this one is that this had some really fascinating numbers in terms of their marketing impact that I wanted to share with you. So they talk about their media coverage, and they have this ridiculously huge number of impressions. I don't know how they calculate that, but we're not talking about press trips right now, so I'm going to leave that be. But what I want you to look at is their marketing numbers. So they talk about different conferences they've gone to, and then they start talking about their website, okay? Now, they do have some room nights that are booked specifically through their website. So, for instance, you can book hotels in Ontario through the Tourism Board's website. But check this out, okay? Their total number of website visits is about 200,000. Now, like for a blogger, that sounds great. But for a tourism board, that's actually on the low side. But you want to know what's particularly on the low side. Where did it go? Digital marketing. Check this out. On Instagram, they have 423 followers. They don't actually, and on Facebook, they have 21,000 likes. This is a huge difference here, right? So there's clearly a disconnect between what they're doing on Facebook and what they're doing on Instagram, and probably even on Twitter. And if we go back up and we look at what they're doing with their digital marketing, you'll see that a lot of their digital marketing is coming from this festival. So we're going to talk a bit about different types of things that you can work with tourism boards on, and events are certainly one of them. But what I really want to call out here, and again, like I said, this is a great annual report, includes so much more information, especially for a tourism board this size, than most of them do. But what I really want to call out here is the specificity of these numbers, okay? And if you look, so this is that the Greater Ontario Facebook page itself has only 1,500 likes, which makes me think that this number has actually been created by adding all of these together. And these other two numbers of the Instagram followers and the Twitter followers have probably been done the same way. So what this tells me is that there's a huge gap between what this tourism board does in terms of its overall marketing, kind of the level of professionality and just the overall ambiance of the destination that it projects versus what's actually going on the web right now. So why am I talking to you about these numbers about social media marketing if we're talking about blogging? So let's go back to our original slides for a second. The reason is that, to go back to something else that Dan Gibson from Visit Tucson said last time, sometimes he feels like he's blogging just because he needs something to share on social media. And this is incredibly important because a lot of, whether it's companies or tourism boards or just companies in other sectors, everybody knows that they need to be sharing on social media right now. But the interesting thing is that they are doing it in this backwards way. So they're saying, we need stuff to share on social media. And so they're creating things from scratch just to share on social media. Whereas what's much easier is to create content in one place, like a blog or some other page on your website, that you then share on social media that comes back to that page. So one of the reasons that we want to get into blogging, that we want to sell blogging, that we want to promote blogging, and that we want to use that as the focal point for our work with travel companies and tourism boards is that all of that social media needs to go somewhere. And social media can't just go to a sales page. It can't just go, for instance, for a tour company to their tour page because they're going to lose eyeballs that way. Because one of the statistics that I dug up that I wanted to share with you is that customers want to see 4 to 7 pages on the website of the place that they are going to purchase from, or that like they're going to go if it's a destination, before they pull the trigger. And so what that means is that all of this social that everybody's so crazy about, it needs to come back somewhere. And that's really one of the reasons that a lot of brands, a lot of whether that's travel companies or tourism boards, are starting these websites. And we're going to look at another. But first, to go back to what I have pulled up here. So this is from Las Cruces in New Mexico. And this is what their marketing department had done in their previous annual report. And they said one of the things that they did was that they built the current brand and they used this Find Your Reason, which is Find Your Reason to Visit campaign. And the very first thing that they talk about is the blog. And then they talk about how they redesigned it to make it more user-friendly. And then they talk about the social media channels. So this is kind of the right approach, is that you need to have the content on the blog and for sharing on social media. You need to make it findable, and then you need to push it out. So this is really kind of the order of operations, order of tasks, the best way to approach it that we want to be reaching out with. So again, with blogging, I talked about how a lot of tourism boards and travel companies are getting into it now, but there's some very specific, demonstrable, numeric reasons for that. So I pulled a bunch of statistics here, and these are all from HubSpot. If you guys are looking for places to read about content marketing or to find these statistics for your own proposal, HubSpot, where these statistics come from, I really recommend. And they pull together kind of a mega list every year of all of the statistics having to do with digital marketing kind of in any facet. So they've got statistics about SEO, the ROI of SEO and working on your SEO, they have video marketing, they have Instagram, they have Twitter, they really have everything. So anytime you are looking for statistics to put in either your pitches or your proposals, this is a place I really recommend starting. So I pulled these particular statistics for you because I really want to talk for a minute about how we show that blogging specifically is the place to start. So I told you why, but how we show it is, like I said, by tying that back into the return on investment. So in order to talk about return on investment, we need to think about what, like I said, what people are selling. In the case of companies, that's pretty clear. It's, you know, a tour, or if it's a hotel, it's a hotel room. With CVBs and tourism boards, like I said, it's a little more broad. They're sort of bottom line is measured in economic impact and room nights and a couple different factors. But all of that relates back to leads. So how many of you guys are familiar with the term lead, L-E-A-D, but not in the journalism context, in the sales context? And also on that note, as you're telling me yes or no, if you're familiar with leads, Adrian has also mentioned that the Content Marketing Institute is very useful for trends and statistics. And that's true. There's a couple other ones that I recommend, and I'm just going to put this in the search bar because everyone's going to ask me what I said. So the Content Marketing Institute, and then another one that I recommend is Contently's blog, The Content Strategist. And then, like I said, HubSpot is a really good place both for content as well as for statistics. So I've put all those names out there. Yeah, so a lot of you guys are familiar with leads. And I know some of you have backgrounds. For instance, there's somebody on the call today who is a travel agent. So some of you have backgrounds in other facets of tourism that work with things like leads. So leads are really a sales term that's not travel specific. It's really kind of business-wide for somebody who could potentially be interested in. Okay, so we're so far away from the sale right now. So a lead is somebody who's not qualified, we're not sure, but there's somebody who has demonstrated some interest in what it is that you're selling. And remember, like I said, with travel companies, what they're selling is very clear, and we can go on their website and figure out the price of that thing very easily. With tourism boards, lead is a bit more general of a term. But what I want us to think about is that leads are the most easily measurable type of return on investment that we can talk about in terms of marketing. Because it's very difficult to track, you know, somebody came to this website or saw us on Instagram, and then like 6 months later, they've booked a trip to this destination. That's very, very difficult to track. There's companies that try to do it, especially affiliate marketing companies have a lot of ways to do it, and even they're not 100% successful. But a lead, so someone who is interested, has seen something and pursues that interest, that's much easier for us to look at. So some statistics around how blogging has an impact on leads that I really want to share with you are very much to show that one blog post a week, which is what a lot of companies and tourism boards do, is not cutting it. So companies that published 16 or more, so that's basically every other day, blog posts per month, got 3.5 times more traffic than companies that published 0 to 4 monthly blog posts. Okay, now it breaks out into B2B and B2C. So B2B and B2C, if you guys aren't familiar, is business to business and business to consumer. So what that means is, in a way, when I talk to you guys, it's B2B because you guys have freelance businesses and I'm talking to you about how to impact your freelance business. Another way to think of B2B is, for instance, you know, let's take not Office Space. Why am I blanking on the name? The Office, the television show, right? They're selling office products. So everyone that they are selling, you know, whether it's paper, printers, whatever, anyone who's selling office products is inherently selling them to another business, okay? Whereas business to consumer is like Coca-Cola. So they might be doing also some selling to restaurants and things like that, but all of the campaigns that we would see from Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whatnot are all business to consumer. They're designed for one individual person who is buying one individual Pepsi, you know, per day or per hour or however crazy their soda habit is, right? So that's the difference between B2B and B2C. So one of the interesting things that I want to point out here is that B2B companies that blog 11 or more times a month have 3x more traffic, 3 times more traffic, than those blogging 0 to 1 a month. So for a B company, there's a bigger leap in terms of going from 0 times to 11 times. That's a lot more posts that should be added. However, B2C, so business-to-consumer companies, so this is the travel companies that we're looking at working with, and also tourism boards, which are reaching out to consumers. They have a larger leap, so they get 4 times as many leads when they go from blogging 4 or 5 times a month, which is like once a week, to 11 times a month. So what this means is that for the travel companies and tour boards that we're looking at working with, even if they already have a blog, they're going to get a very significant jump in leads by adding fewer posts, for instance, than B2B. But generally, just by adding, you know, another block of posts a month, whether it's 2 times or 3 times a week. Now, somebody pointed out and this interesting stat at the top, which I was going to circle back to, which is compounding versus decaying post. Okay? So what it means is something that if you have a blog or you've worked in a publishing context of any kind, you're probably familiar with. It's the concept of evergreen content versus newsy content. And so this is something that I think all of us understand when you put it in that context. So a compounding blog post in this context means something that's evergreen. It means something that can be used over time. The reason that they use the word compounding here is that the traffic compounds. So it doesn't start and sort of peter off, that's the decaying posts, but it starts and as it gains more links, as it's been around longer, the traffic rate goes up. So essentially what this post is saying, or sorry, what this statistic is saying, is that for these posts that we're looking at doing for travel companies and tourism boards, news posts are significantly less valuable than posts that deliver value over time, posts that are evergreen. And we're going to look a little bit later at what type of content I would recommend that you propose, but it's really related to this. Content that can be used again and again and again, regardless of season or year or whatnot, is infinitely more valuable. And one of the reasons I stick in here is if you find a blog, a tourism board blog or a travel company blog, which is really focused right now without your input on highlighting newsy things, whether it's, you know, events that are happening in a destination or just the upcoming tour schedule of a tour company or other things that are going on in the destination where the tour company operates, this statistic helps show them how that's not an effective strategy for them. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about definitions, the framework. I know we're having an MBA in travel content marketing right now, but I promise we're going to get out of the weeds in a little bit. So one other thing that I want to make sure that you guys are thinking about as you talk, not just to the travel companies and the tourism boards, but even as you talk yourself through what you might want to be offering. So is the concept of a customer journey. So the thing about a customer journey is we're all familiar with it because we all do it all the time. But with content marketing, which is what blogging is, but particularly with blogging, it is crucial for companies and tourism boards to think about how the posts that they are putting up fit into their customer journey. Because otherwise, like we said up here, otherwise they're decaying posts and they're a waste of the company or the tourism board's money to be assigning you that work. So the way that customer journeys work, there's a lot of different metrics for this, but I like this one because it's less buzzwordy and kind of easier to grasp onto. So it starts with unhappiness. So this is, for instance, let's take a scenario. Labor Day is coming up. You have no plans. You really want to get away and do something, but you are not going to book a flight. You live in a very active area where there's probably going to be a lot of people both driving in to where you live and to other areas nearby. So essentially, you feel a bit screwed. So you feel unhappy because you don't have plans for Labor Day. And you feel like at this point, you're just probably not going to make any. It's probably just not going to happen for you, and you're unhappy because you have nothing to do. So the desire, obviously, is to be less unhappy. It's to have something to do. what are your many options? Your many options are, you know, perhaps to do something where you live, to have a staycation, to go somewhere nearby, to get a cheap flight. Maybe you can get a deal on a train ride so you don't have to drive. And then within that, there's destination options. There's so many different destination options, right? And then you eventually make a final decision, whether that final decision is to stay home and do nothing, or, you know, to rent all of the Harry Potter movies and have a big Harry Potter marathon party rather than go somewhere, or you find a deal on a B&B nearby that includes dinners and also a spa stay. There's many different things that could be your final option, but the final option is something specific that you've narrowed down, that is the right fit for your desire, given the many options that are available. And then after you check out reviews, talk to your spouse or whoever else is involved about the price, then you finally decide on that final option. So does that concept of the customer journey make sense to you guys? Like I said, I like this one because it's not so buzzword heavy. There's a lot of different ways of talking about the customer journey that does have a lot of buzzwords. But this one I feel like is something emotional, very experience-based that we can all relate to. So the concept of the customer journey as it relates to blog content, what does that look like? So unhappiness is where inspirational content might come in. This is why Instagram has blown up so quickly as a major force in terms of social media and content, because that photo that makes you feel for half a second like you're on a beach in Sardinia or something, rather than sitting at your office where the air conditioner is blasting so high that you have to wear a parka in the summer and then feel like you're dying when you go outside and it's humid. That little moment on Instagram helps with the unhappiness, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a specific desire. So there's a lot of content out there which is kind of vaguely mood lifting and travel related that fits into this unhappiness part of the customer journey. But what about the desire part, right? So when I talked about the desire in the Labor Day example that I gave you, the desire was to get out of town for a specific weekend and something. People's desires around travel do tend to have a certain level of specificity. It can either be that they want to travel a certain week, that they want to do a beer tour, that they want to go somewhere with really barbecue, that they want to do something with 12 family members, that they want to do a road trip. It has some level of specificity, but not too much. So the type of things that fit really well into that part of the desire section of the customer journey are often roundups, because roundups can give you a lot of options, the next part, right, can give you a lot of options around desire and help you start to get to that point where you're creating your own personal list of what those options are. So good roundups for this would be, you know, say that your unhappiness is that you're getting married and that you want to take a honeymoon, but like so many people these days, it's very hard to coordinate the travel schedules around that, and you really can't take 2 or 3 weeks off just because of the nature of the job that you have and the fact that you're already doing travel writing on the side and you use some vacation days for that. And so you just can't figure out how to take 2 or 3 days off, or neither can your fiance, but you want to have a vacation, honeymoon vacation, where you're doing something vacation-like. You want something relaxing, something beachy, but you just don't know how to make it because of the season or because of the prices or something like that. So you're unhappy because you want to have this thing and it just doesn't seem possible. So the desire then is to find an affordable honeymoon. So this is where roundups like affordable honeymoon destinations, just 2 hours from San Francisco or 2 hours from New York or 2 hours from Chicago, come in. This is where roundups are really useful and why they don't die. A lot of us complain about roundups, especially people who have had their own blog for a long time and want to write longer form content and feel like they don't understand why people just love the roundups in their blog and won't read anything else. But this is what's useful about roundups, is they help people move from desire to many options. So on a lot of, especially travel company websites, not quite so much with tourism boards, but particularly with travel company websites, you see a lot of these roundup style things that cater to desire moving into many options. So like I said, the many options phase is where people now have an abundance of choice. They've gone from feeling like something isn't possible to expressing exactly what it is that they want, and then finding different ways to fit into that desire. And now they have a lot of options. The thing about options is that you have to narrow them down. So this is where blog content that really talks about the nuts and bolts of different things comes in. So a really good example of this is itinerary content. Itinerary content right now is huge on tourism board websites. It's so huge, in fact, that there are entire multiple different apps that are developing to help people who are coming to tourism board websites put together personal itineraries based on sample itineraries that are on their website, essentially replacing the concept of a personal travel agent, not just in general, but by allowing the tourism board itself to be your personal travel agent without actually talking to you. So the many options phase is really well served by two things, by itineraries and also by content that helps you know if something is right for you or not. But that's particularly the bailiwick of the final option phase. So like I said, in the final option is where you think you have something, and now you're starting to read reviews, you're getting really into the logistics, and you're trying to figure out if this makes sense for you. So the final option phase, a really good example for this is for travel companies, okay? So let's say that you have a service which does concierge travel bookings. So you do itineraries, you're like a travel agent, except you don't have the actual license, and you essentially perhaps had a blog that was specialized in a different location, and people started asking you for tips, and then you said, okay, sure, yeah, I can help you plan your trip, but wait, I'm doing this for free too much, so let me start charging for it. And then you started charging $150 an itinerary. So this is your business. And so somebody knows that they want to go, I can't remember if I said a city already, but let's say they know they want to go to California wine country, and they've seen that that is your specialty, and they've hung out on your blog for a little bit, and they're trying to decide if they're going to choose you to plan their trip versus doing it themselves, or doing a tour or something like that. And they're pretty sure that they want to choose you. So what type of content do they need now? Now they need blog posts that will help them confirm that decision. So in this case, it might be testimonials from people who have used your services in the past. It might be details about exactly how you work. Let's say instead that their final option that they were considering is the tour company. So they might want to see details about, you know, when the company picks them up and drops them off and what they can expect in the middle. This is really the phase where you're addressing and clarifying expectations. And like I said, there's a lot of different types of content that can go to that. And then the decision phase, this is something where it's less about content and more about the shopping cart. And again, not so much something that you're going to see on the blog. But all of these other phases, particularly desire, where there's a lot of roundups, unhappiness, like we said, is really well served by photos, which can be on Instagram or Pinterest or also on the blogs, also on Facebook. But many option and final options are really well served by various blog posts, whether that's itineraries or these kind of explainers, as they're often referred to now, that have a lot of nitty-gritty details. So if you really are into this idea of figuring out blog post ideas for your journey, another resource I'll point you to, like I said, we're in like MBA class today, so we're very resource heavy, is Deloitte & Touche, which is a major management consulting firm, did a big study on travel booking recently. And they came up with this concept of micro moments, which has another way of looking at the customer journey, which, like this one that I used, is very closely tied in with all of our personal experience and very easy to understand. So that's another place to look if you want to use the customer journey around designing specific blog posts that you can offer tourism boards. But regardless, I promise you 100%, if you bring up customer journey when talking to a tourism board or a travel company about how you are planning their blog content, they will just like start worshiping you because they don't have time to think about such a thing, but they really should be. So let's get a little bit more into the sales part of this, the how, why, ROI, we talked about already, but I want to get more specific. So this is from the Content Marketing Institute, which Adrian mentioned earlier. And this is on a piece on the difficulties of travel content marketing. And this is a quote that they had that's not exactly a quote, so I just kind of quoted the article directly. And it says, the wealth of channels, and by channels they mean whether it's blog or Instagram or Snapchat, all these different things, makes budget prioritization difficult, according to Neil Chernofsky, associate publisher of digital at North Star Travel Group. One of the major challenges travel and tourism marketers face is how to allocate budget and resources against the many channels of travel. So what are these, you know, budget constraints, right? We talked about how social is something that a lot of tourism boards particularly, but also companies, are measuring. They're measuring the output. They're measuring the final numbers. But they're not necessarily looking at what's going into that and how their time is being best spent. So like I said way back at the top of the call, the content that goes into that is fastest, is best served if it starts from a blog piece that can then be pivoted into multi-channel content. I talked about how we were going to do a little bit of definitions, and this has come kind of later after I've set a lot of the groundwork in terms of how CVBs and DMOs and everything think. But I say these every call, and people always ask, so I just wanted to get a little bit into DMO and CVB differences. And then I want to talk about earned and owned content, which is something that relates to this multi-channel issue that the gentleman from North Star mentioned that I'm not sure that you guys are all familiar with, but it relates to the differences between DMOs and CVBs. So I use the term tourism board throughout a lot of this call because I feel like it's a little easier to hold on to. So in travel, there's several different types of entities that might function as the tourism boards for different destinations. So one is a DMO, and I don't usually use this term quite so much as it's a bit more squishy. So a destination marketing organization or a destination management organization, it can be either way, is not always a nonprofit or governmental entity. Now, it can be sometimes they use that moniker, but by and large, this is more of a third party that is managing or marketing the destination on behalf of the local government or the Chamber of Commerce or even a tourism board. So sometimes there's a tourism board and also a DMO which focuses on marketing. There's a lot of different structures that this can take. Whereas a convention and visitors bureau is typically funded by some variety of taxes. So we talked earlier about occupancy taxes, and there's also other types of hotel taxes that can go into that. There's also grants, or there's parts of city or state budgets that can go into funding convention and visitors bureaus. But one of the things is that a convention and visitors bureau tends to have a very large portion of its activity around non-leisure business. So what do I mean by that? So non-leisure business in this context of travel tends to be one of two things. One of them is group travel, which is, you know, tours and things like that. But most importantly, a lot of it is meetings travel. This is really, really huge these days, and I mention it often because it's a really important sector for you guys to think about generally, but it's a particularly important sector to think about when interacting with any tourism boards. Because meetings business, you know, whether it's a small board meeting that does a lot of very expensive things, or a conference with 3,000 or 7,000 or 20,000 people, I went to a conference in DC that had like 200,000 people, these are a huge share of what tourism boards think about because it's more visitors in one conversation. You talk to one meeting planner and you get all of these visitors, right? What about interacting with leisure customers? So this is something that obviously both DMOs and CVBs have to do, but if you look at where their money demonstrably comes from, it means that that portion can often get less of their direct time. So visitor centers, which we're all super familiar with, are the portion of the CVB, or in some cases the DMO, that does a lot of that face-to-face time. So visitor centers exist everywhere, and they're one of the resources for content that I think is least often tapped. So I just want to take 2 seconds and say that if you are talking to tourism boards that are strapped for resources, one of the best things to advocate is getting content from people who work for the visitor center. And when I say getting content, it doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be writing it. A lot of visitor centers are staffed with volunteers, and sometimes they're, you know, former professors or other very well-educated professionals who would be very apt to be writing that content. And you, rather than writing all the content for a tourism board, can take more of the curation role of organizing the content that comes from those individuals. However, one of the things that the tourism information centers, sometimes they're called our welcome centers, One of the things that people who work there are really great for is questions that visitors are asking. So one of the main things that I like to do with all of my clients of the type of blogging nature that we're talking about is ask them what type of questions their customers have. And the people who sit in the marketing office at the CVB or the DMO don't always know. They might have a sense, they might know what people are asking on the internet, but they don't really know what people who actually show up to the destination, what those people care about. They know more about what prospects are asking, but that doesn't necessarily transfer to the actual bookings, right? So again, just a note on this, but if you can get to the people who work in the welcome centers and figure out from them what they think people need to know about, that's a huge selling point and something often that these tourism boards haven't thought about. Now, on the travel company side, like I said, you can just ask the owner because often the owner is the one interacting with the customers. If the company is a bit larger, ask them if you can talk to the people who are doing the bookings. For instance, if it's a tour company, the person who handles the email or other customer service people. Now, let's talk about, like I said, these other two definitions, which are related both to the type of entity and also to this quote that I had up here about how one of the major challenges is allocating budgets and resources. So, how many of you guys have heard of earned versus owned media? I think I've mentioned this very much in passing in some past webinars and had people be confused. So I want to take a minute on this because as you look at annual reports like I talked about, or you start to converse with tourism boards and also with companies, but generally with travel marketing professionals about their marketing efforts, this is really important because do you remember before I talked about impressions and I said how the Greater Ontario CVB had a crazy high number for impressions, and then we talked about that ROI impact of about 30-1. Both of these get into the difference between earned and owned media. So earned media is when somebody that you haven't paid, now when we get to talking about press trips this is a little wonky, but the idea is that somebody that you haven't paid, as in it's not explicitly an ad, has said something about you. So that's earned. So essentially, by being awesome, you know, in short terms, you have generated this bit of publicity or this bit of chatter about yourself. Owned media, however, is something that you have said. So paid media is a third type that we're not going to talk about because we're not talking about advertising. So the difference here is a piece of content that you have created and distributed is owned media. A piece of content someone has written about you that has been distributed on a channel that you don't control is earned media. So along with paid, which like I said is not partial to the discussion right now, these three things, earned and owned and paid, go to the budget that CVBs and also travel companies are spending on their marketing. Now, even the smallest, okay, even the tiniest Convention Visitors Bureau, Tourism Board, is spending, if not five figures, then six figures on this. And eight figures is quite common. So the amount of money going into the mix, going to be allocated to these different things, is big. We are talking about substantial numbers. So one of the reasons that I waited to say this, and I talked about return on investment and customer journey and all of these things, is that I wanted you to understand what the opportunities are before I show you how incredibly easy they are to get. So I was at a conference recently where someone shared some statistics from a very informal study that I'm not going to quote because the gathering methods were a little awkward. But the gentleman sharing it said a bit sadly that tourism boards are only devoting, you know, 5% or 10% of their budget to working with bloggers. And I was like, holy cow, dude, do you know how much physical actual money that is? That's enormous. So let's make it even smaller. Forget about 5% or 10%. If you just want $500 a month, $1,000 a month to do some blog posts for a tourism board, that is like a tiny, tiny piece of their budget. It is so tiny and so insignificant that the difficulty isn't getting the money. The difficulty is to get them to have that conversation with you in the first place. And also for travel companies, like tours and activities. I want to just take a second. I keep talking about tours and boards, and I know I said I was going to talk about both because for us, in terms of pitching, they're very similar, but the markets are different. I just want to take a second to talk about the size of the market, the amount of money we're talking about when we talk about tours. So you may have noticed Airbnb has these new experiences. Have any of you guys seen this? I haven't booked them yet. I'm kind of curious to do one just to do it, but it's not really my thing, and I'm curious to see how that actually pans out for them because I know they invested a significant amount of money in setting up all of these experiences. But a lot of us are probably familiar with Viator, right? Because they commission writers. So Viator and Airbnb Experiences are two more aggregator style examples of this tour and activities market. But we're all familiar with the food tours that have been popping up everywhere. If any of you guys have been to Wits or TBEX or anything like that, you've probably been on one of these smaller tours that's popping up. There's haunted house tours, there's marijuana tours, right? The marijuana tour market is huge now. But the point is that the tour and activity market as a whole is picking up steam in this incredible way. So I pulled up a couple different statistics here that you guys can look over, perhaps have already looked over, but I particularly want to pull your attention to this last one. In the US alone, there's approximately 67,000 businesses valued at $20 billion in the tour and activity market. So anytime you feel like you don't have someone to pitch, we talked about tours and boards, right? But these travel companies are huge and there are so many of them. So this statistic goes on to say this makes it the third largest segment of the travel industry after air and accommodation, guys. So that's not restaurants. After air and accommodation, it's not food, it's tour and activity markets, okay? So this is a huge place for us to be doing. So no matter where you live or where you like to travel or where your travel expertise is, there has got to be some sort of tour and activity company that lines up with that you could be pitching blogging services to. Okay, so let's get in to the physical selling part. So we talked about how you can talk to them about ROI. We looked at what the budgets are. We looked at what the options are. We've even talked a bit about what type of content you can pitch them and how that fits in the customer journey so that you can show them why they need that content. What are some questions that you should ask yourself before you pitch or try to work with a specific company? So, have they considered blogging? This is an interesting one. I got a pitch to review the other day as part of the one-off query critiques that I do. And it was a content marketing pitch, and it was for, I'm not sure if I want to say the exact entity, but it was for a sort of boutique hotel slash social club chain, so to say, that exists around the world. And it's a very recognizable brand. It's not new. It's been around for decades. It does very well for itself. They have, multiple locations in London. They're in New York. They're really all over in the large markets. And this was a very basic pitch on, hey, blogging is really, blowing up. Here's some blog posts that we could do for your location or for your company. And the thing is that you have to start anytime you're approaching something of size and reputation and longevity with the assumption that even if you don't see a blog on their website overtly, they have no doubt considered it. So this means any tourism board, if they don't have something that looks like a blog, they have no doubt thought of it before. So what does that mean? It means even if you don't see something there, or some reason they haven't overtly started a blog, or they have something that you can't see that's on a non-public link that they direct people to from their newsletter or something like that. So you should always start, unless you are approaching a travel company, a tour company that's very new, like a year or two old, with the assumption that they're already blogging in some way that you might just not notice, or that they've thought about it and there's a reason that they aren't doing it in a way that you can see. which means they might be working on it right now or something like that. But this is very important when writing your pitch. So for instance, if it's a tourism board, if it's that Greater Ontario one that I showed you before when we looked at the annual report, you can approach them with the angle that you notice that their social numbers are much lower than their media impressions, and talk about the importance of blogging and the statistics and the lead generation, and say something like, if this is something that you haven't considered, I'd love to talk to you about how we can get started. If you're already working on it, I'd love to lend my expertise about how to make sure it gets going in the right direction. But never just presume that just because you don't see something that they don't have it, okay? Now, in terms of figuring out what should go on the blog or in your proposal, I talked about before something that you can do once you're already, you know, on the phone with them or already talking with them, which is the idea of talking with whoever their customer service people are or their frontline staff at the welcome centers about the questions that they get from customers. But what do you do when you're just looking at approaching somebody in terms of knowing what they should be covering? I would look on their website and see what they talk about, and then go back to Google and put those things into search and see what comes up. Are they actually ranking for the search terms that they probably should be ranking for according to what they're covering? And if not, this is something that you can immediately jump in and offer to help with. Because search engine results pages, or SERPs, if you guys don't know this term, it's very commonly used. SERPs, I just put that in the chat box, are incredibly important in travel marketing right now, because there's this huge battle going on that you guys might not be aware of between Google and essentially everybody, which is that Google has started not only having the questions come into Google, but it's also providing you with specific responses. So they're not just providing you with facilitation to the correct answer, but they're trying to point you to the correct answer. So for instance, if you were to Google, what is the weather like in Ellenville, New York, where the retreat house is, Google is going to take up half or more of the search results page, giving you its own weather diagnostics. It might pull out from its decided top search result a snippet, like a little clip of text, but most of that page that you're going to get is answers that are provided by Google. So how does this translate for travel? So if you Google where to stay in blah, blah, blah place, it is going to match you up to a bunch of hotels that it is promoting, which are through its partnership with Zagat Guides. Or if you Google an attraction, it's going to offer you Google's place to book that attraction. So right now, it is so much harder to get towards the top of a search results page simply because most of the top of the search results page is provided by Google itself. So ranking well for different keywords is more important than ever. And then you say, oh my God, ranking for keywords, this is not something I want to get into. They should go hire like an SEO specialist. But the thing is that, and I don't have these statistics in here because there's just so many. The thing is that right now, content marketing is the best way to rank for SEO, not by writing, you know, keyword stuffed thing, but by writing content that informs. And just as, you know, a statistic to throw out there, on average, the results on the first page of Google search results for any search term have 1,800 words on those pages. So what that means is that, you know, long content is one way to put it, but it's really informative and complete content is really what is working right now. And then another statistic, keywords that are best performing, easiest to rank for right now, tend to be 4 to 7 words. So if you guys have ever heard of the concept of long tail keywords, so that means rather than honeymoons in Bermuda, you would be looking for honeymoons in Bermuda in October, or luxury honeymoons in Bermuda in October. Those are keywords that are much easier to rank for now. So these are the kind of things where when you're looking at working with a company or a tourism board, you can look at what they think that they're covering, what they think that people are coming to their website for, and then go back and see if that's actually happening. And if there's a disconnect, then blog content that creates more pages on the travel company or tourism board's website around those topics in a more informative fashion can help bridge that gap. Now, I have something on here. Do they need a sideways blog? So this is an interesting concept that I have noticed kind of generally around the webs, but I'm starting to see come to travel, which is that companies have blogs about things that seem very peripherally related to what they sell, that they really, really push hard on. So I know I mention this often, but a lot of you guys might be familiar with the Freelancer blog from Contently. How many of you guys know the Freelancer? Great blog, lots of content. It's around freelance writing, but also general freelance writing. And that's a good example because the Freelancer, it's around how to make more money as a freelance, you know, designer, writer, what have you. But what Contently sells is content marketing services to companies. So having a blog about freelancing is very peripheral to what it sells. It makes sense because it helps get writers to trust them and then work for them, et cetera, and so on. But it's peripheral to what it actually sells. And a lot of tourism boards are starting to do this. And this is perhaps one of the best opportunities to get into blogging for tourism boards that don't already have a blog, is to offer something peripheral. So I showed you earlier on one of the very first slides about Las Cruces has this Find Your Something campaign or something like this. A lot of campaigns that tourism boards are doing now seem a bit peripheral. They seem more about, you know, you as the traveler and what do you like to do. Or one of the things that's really pervasive now for tourism boards is to have blogs for meeting planners about how to plan better meetings. So I don't just harp to you guys about meeting planning because it's something that I've written about, but it's because it's really a big place for content right now. And so you can look at what other things can your destination that you're looking at or your travel company that you're looking at, what else can they blog about that can help the people who are their customers in another way, which is not directly related to what they sell, but what will build trust in that brand. So those are really great places to slide in where you can offer something that the travel company, the tourism board hadn't thought about. So there's really a lot of examples of those, but like I said, some of the good ones are outside of the travel space. So another one is Adobe, which we all know is a creative suite. They have Adobe Illustrator, Photoshop, of course, Lightroom for editing photos. They have a blog called CMO, which is for chief marketing officers. And it's all about how to be a chief marketing officer, as in, you know, statistics that you need, how to do measurement and analytics, how to make different decisions, trends, things like that. Does it have to do with using their software? No, never. They don't talk about their software. But the assumption is that the decision makers for an expensive product like Adobe, that's the best place to be. It's the best place, the person to be interacting with. So you can think about when you're looking at destinations, and especially with companies, who it is that they're talking to and what else those people really need to know about that can be on their blogs. So for instance, like if you are a concierge travel specialist for California Wine Country, your whole blog can be, you know, profiling interesting winery owners, talking about what's new, the different vintages. Like, yes, that's about wine, and this is a closer example, but you're selling tours. So it doesn't necessarily have to be about the statistics of those tours. It can be about the interesting stories that are out there in wine country that people should be coming to explore, and your tours are a great way to do it. So these are some ways to think about sideways blogs. So we talked also about what type of content you should propose quite a bit when we talk about customer journeys. And I just want to reiterate a couple things here. Itineraries are really, really big for CVB blogs right now, for tourism board blogs. They're also relatively big for a lot of travel companies. But what's more important to think about is that other statistic that I mentioned on the last slide, which is 1,800 words, okay? That's the kind of blog posts that are showing up on the first page of Google search results. Itineraries very easily fall into that. Roundups do as well. Profiles can as well. But think about what type of content is really meaty and helps with different points on the customer journey. So don't necessarily just think about, you know, like, I really like this restaurant, this in this destination, I'm working with the CVB blog, how can I write about this restaurant? Think about, how can I package that restaurant into something that's going to help a customer at a certain point in their customer journey, while also providing a very comprehensive look at something that somebody coming in from search is going to be interested in. So these are the different factors that you should think about when you're looking at what type of content you propose. And keep in mind that news doesn't work very well, newsy things, okay? So as I mentioned earlier that we were going to circle back to, convention visitors bureaus really focus on events. When we were on the Greater Ontario Annual Report, we looked at this. They're all about these four or five different festivals that they do. Important things to remember, like I said, is that in line. So if you are going to be writing about or proposing to write about or are asked to write about different annual events, it's really important to look at ways to make that content evergreen so that it works for them year round. Now, I know we're over time and I really appreciate you guys sticking with us. And I apologize again for the technical difficulties at the beginning of the call, but we're going to have a new platform next month and I'm so excited. So I just wanted to say something really quick about branching to social. There's a big reason why I'm saying that blogging feeds to social, social is really important, but I'm not telling you to do social, okay? Social media marketing, social media management, being the person to physically be available to respond to tweets and whatnot is a horrible use of your time as a freelancer. You do not sit at a desk all day, you do not want to sit at a desk all day, you should not sit at a desk all day, and you do not want to get yourself into a contract which is going to limit your ability to do other work because you need to be on call 24/7 for social. Now, accompanying your blog post submissions with text that is formatted for different platforms, totally. That's totally something that you can offer as an add-on that costs more. As in, once they've been working with you for a while, you say, hey, by the way, why don't you pay me twice as much and I'll give you all these other things. Or you can work to train them to be better at sharing your posts so you can have meetings with them and train their internal staff. But I do not recommend that you offer social media marketing because it is not a good use of your time and it's going to impinge on all of the things that made you want to get into travel writing, as in being able to travel and not be at your desk. So one quick thing as well on return on investment. So I looked at this early in the call and I want to just make sure that I put it in very plain terms. So for tourism and travel companies, two different ways of showing return on investment, okay? For tourism boards, it's about exposure. It's about eyeballs. It's about that eventual economic impact, which is very difficult to track. So in the case of tourism boards, you want to show that the money that they are spending on you is significantly less, like I said, 1 to 30 is a good ratio, than what they would pay for the same number of eyeballs through ads. So what that means is it's very easy to go and check out in Google what the going rate for a specific keyword is and see how much they would have to shell out to get a certain number of eyeballs on a blog post with that keyword just using Google Ads versus saying, but you'd only have to pay me this much to write this post, okay? With travel companies, the return on investment is about direct bookings, and this is very easy because you just look at the price of the tours and then show how that relates to the lead generation statistics that I showed you earlier, right? So four times more leads, et cetera, versus your rate. So say, this is why it's good to go after more lucrative tours rather than just, you know, a $15, $25 barbecue tour. So say you're looking at a company that does safaris in Africa. I'll use those because they're really easy in terms of price point. And it costs like $6,500 for one safari, okay? If they're going to generate four times as many leads by adding more blog posts, make sure that what you are offering is, let's say, you know, 1/4 of one tour. And then we're looking at a 16 times different, okay? So you are pricing yourself so that you're significantly less than one tour and they're getting four times as many leads. So you look dirt cheap in comparison with them getting the business from these new leads that is being generated, okay? So you want to make sure, and we talk a lot about, you know, pricing for your hourly rate and all these things, but when we're looking at how to price for travel companies and tourism boards, I recommend starting to think about your pricing, not just in terms of how long does it take you to do this work, blah, 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 but start to think about your pricing, about what they can afford, and what you can convince them of, and then backtrack. So if you're going to offer $1,500 a month for blog posts, how many blog posts? How much time is that going to take you? How many photos are you going to put in there? Are you going to ask them to do the photos? Whatever. But first figure out what's a good number for them to afford, to be okay with, and then backtrack in terms of what you're going to offer. Okay? Thanks so much, you guys. Adriana has a good question, so I want to address that for all of you guys. Are you suggesting to pitch blog posts up to 1,500 words based on ranking? I'm suggesting to pitch blog posts of 1,500 or 1,800 words because that's what establishes authority, and then that's what Google ranks better. So it's actually more because that's what performs and works better for the end goals of having a blog, which is to get more bookings and to build trust with customers and so on and so forth, rather than simply because it has a search effect. So the answer is no, I'm not suggesting it based on ranking, but yes, it also does affect that as well.